My name's Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education. It's my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing lecture series here each fall and each spring. This fall, I believe we go through November 15th, if that is a Tuesday. I think that's right, November 15th. So I invite you to get online and check the schedule out. Pick out the ones that are must-sees for you and come back and visit us on Tuesday nights. Next week, we have David Pagel, curator, and Los Angeles Times art critic. Oh, we still, it's not everybody. You know, it's the architects that are dragging him. We should have said we're starting at 7:05 because it's an architecture-based program. Okay, I will begin again. The point I really want to make is that next week we have David Pagel here, who is a curator of some note, also Los Angeles Times art critic and chair and associate professor of art theory and history at Claremont University in Claremont, California. He is here to present his presentation, which he has titled, very cleverly titled, which I think gives you some insight into David, Getting It Wrong in Just the Right Way, Deben Korn's West Coastism. This is to shed light on the exhibition we currently have upstairs, but I think you can count on it being that and much more. Tonight, as most of you are aware, architect Julie Snow is here from Minneapolis, Minnesota, as the lead juror for the Fort Worth AIA Annual Design Awards. And we appreciate that in addition to her duties as a juror, she has agreed to participate in Tuesday Evenings at the Modern with tonight's lecture on the work of her studio-based practice, Julie Snow Architects, which has been recognized with numerous awards, including the AIA Honor Award, Progressive Architecture Design Award, the Chicago Athenaeum American and International Architecture Awards, Architect Magazine Annual Design Review, the Design Distinction Award from ID Magazine, Business Week and Architectural Record Awards, and U.S. General Services Administration's Design Excellence Awards. The studio's work has appeared in many professional journals nationally and internationally, as well as several surveys of architecture. The work of the studio was exhibited at the Chicago Architectural Foundation, and in 2005, Princeton Architectural Press published the first monograph on the studio's work in its series on emerging designers from around the world. Julie recently received the American Academy of Arts and Letters Architecture Award. The award reads, and I think this is significant, so please bear with me, the architecture of Julie Vandenberg Snow might be characterized as invention within convention. That is not to say that her work is conventional, but to recognize that with a rigorous underpinning, she and her studio make the marvelous happen. Elegance is balanced with pragmatism. She is a ballerina who can dance in work boots. Albert Einstein is quoted as saying, everything should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler. The work of Julie Vandenberg Snow does this. So, in addition to her work as an architect, Julie has held visiting professor positions, including at the Graduate School of Design at Harvard, University of Arkansas, University of Maryland, and Washington University in St. Louis. After teaching at the University of Minnesota College of Architecture and Landscape Architecture, she received the Ralph Rapson Award for Distinguished Teaching. Julie Snow Architects' studio-based practice engages diversity in scale and type of work, which is joined by a common exploration of material and detail. The studio's interest in pragmatic and critical programmatic reflection results in innovative designs that expand the firm's understanding of architectural performance, always cognizant of how architecture performs within each project's social, cultural, and economic context. Please join me in welcoming Julie Snow as she tells us more.
I don't know if I can tell you more. I think that's about all there is. Do I have the power here? How do I move the slides? Do I need a beeper? Anyway, you know what? If we can just go to the next slide, we won't waste any time. Can you just beep me?
Thing here.
There's a beeper. Oh, we got it. Yeah, no, it was in the drawer. It was hidden.
You know, the problem is that you guys are always so prepared, we drop the ball. Because other people we have to guide through this.
Not at all. I'm going to show just a quick film that we did, actually my son and I did, of our studio, and talk a little bit about our practice. I'm going to sort of give a trajectory of the practice over time. And this project shows the studio, and it kind of gives you the context for where all of our work and ideas emanate. The studio that I lead is a very collaborative. We're small. We're based in Minneapolis. We have about 10 core architects that address every project within the studio. We've worked together for quite a while, so we kind of, you know, catch each other's beats and understand one another quite well. In addition, we have also cultivated, we're not getting the film, where we've cultivated a number of, collaborations with other architects, with renderers, with model builders, with engineers, with every type of building consultant. And as we develop our projects, we have both a collaborative sessions like you see here, as well as very heads-down focused work. We try very hard, and this is mostly for the architects in the office, to contain our days in 8 to 9 hour days so that we actually have lives outside the studio and can predict our work. And the work really develops from a very thoughtful approach, but also very controlled and progressing towards the end of delivering our clients' work in a substantial way. This is my dog. I always know when we get to lunch in the video because I hear this. Lennon is trained to eat only pellets, and the pizza is just an interesting smell. So just don't worry that he's going to grab somebody's pizza off their plate. And that was root beer, just so you know. I don't know if that's particularly obvious. The other thing that I think is interesting about the studio space is that we all work together. Clearly, there's no sort of hierarchy within the studio. But we work on the 24th floor in the city of Minneapolis, so we look out on sort of expansive views of landscape and the world. And the test of our work is always how the work performs in the world for our clients. And so this is always something that's in our minds as we go about our days. I'm going to move on. One of the things I really do like about this video, though, is the sort of passage of time over the day, and you see the light in the studio really changing over the course of the day, but we've had enough of that. So we really began our practice. This is a bit saturated, but that's okay. We began our practice, and I'm going really way back in the day here, about 15 years ago, doing very pragmatic projects. So when the American Academy of Arts talks about our practice blending pragmatism and elegance, I really believe that pragmatism comes first. And so we're very much about these manufacturing centers. We're working with engineers, but they also have these intangible goals for the project, which include connecting the sort of management side of the production facility with the production side of the production facility. So the idea is creating this sort of single environment that the team works within, or really reinventing how we think about manufacturing processes with this project, which was called the Origin Center, a way of sharing manufacturing knowledge. And really developed in the Western Wisconsin landscape. Or this project in which we were not asked to create architecture, but we were asked to rethink how a health clinic should operate. And so we began by having conversations with the clinicians. And so we've never done a healthcare clinic, but we start talking with people. How do you operate? How would you like to operate? How are things going? What are your aspirations for the clinic? The first thing they said, bar none, was we want to put the patient in the driver's seat of their own healthcare. And so our question, as we gathered them together for a day-long sort of session, sort of blue sky thinking session, our question was, if you want to put them in the driver's seat, why do you take them, dress them in paper, and walk them down this hallway where they have no idea where they are, and then, or ask them to wait? This is not a political statement. This is, if you had the President of the United States, you can tell how long ago we did this project. If you had the President of the United States here, you wouldn't ask him to go sit in a corner until you're ready for him. Or you wouldn't put him in a room all by himself in which he can hear noises in the corridor. He knows there's something happening, but nobody's showing up. So this one was the idea that you would see the clinicians in the little Pac-Man game, and you have an ETA of their arrival broadcast on the wall. So out of this came these kind of interesting collages that were meant to give you a three-dimensional sense of what the new clinic would be like, but didn't actually design the clinic. We didn't actually have a site. And so here we're talking about an increased collaboration between clinicians. We're talking about how we would reinvent the examination room as the care room. And it would be more about taking care of somebody, a consultation rather than an exam in which one could pass, fail. And the waiting area would be reduced to those who simply brought a patient to the clinic. It would be an opportunity to check your email or check webdoctor.com about, what's going on with your life. And, of course, the ever-present opportunity to purchase something. So this led to some sort of interesting ventures that we had in the early days of helping clients kind of reinvent new things. And so this was a very interesting project. It was actually, we got this project because I met a friend of mine on the elevator, and he said, "Julie, do you know any product designers?" And I said, "No, I don't actually. What are you thinking about?" And he said, "Well, we're thinking about a new kind of dog collar." And I went, "I'd like to talk with you about that." And so this is a web-based dog collar, and instead of implanting a chip in a dog under a dog's skin, you would have it embedded in the dog collar itself and locked on the dog, so he can't get it off. So it would be this sort of necklace, and you can see on it there would be his ID number and securepetid.com website and a 1-800 number. So if somebody found the dog, they could either scan the collar, or they could log on to the website, or they could call the 800 number and have the dog returned to you. And, of course, we didn't feel that that should actually be anything more than a necklace. It shouldn't really be a restraint collar. It doesn't need to be the actual, collar that restrains your dog. But it should be more as a piece of jewelry. It should have this more a sort of lighter sense as it's a web-based device. But it could have some personality. And so we had these beads that would be designed as a product that you could add. And then it also had the compendium, as you can see up here, of the dog's adhesive stickers, so he doesn't make that little clinking sound at night as he walks around. So those are his licenses. Then we were asked to compete for a very interesting project for the new Walker Art Center. This was back when they were building their building. And what they wanted was what they called a telematic table. And the idea here was a way of creating social engagement within the institution itself. So the telematic table was a way of taking three complete strangers. These are actually members of the studio. And having them begin a conversation about art. So the idea was that when you entered, you would receive a wristband, and it would have an RFID tag. And as you came to, for instance, the self-portrait of Chuck Close, you would wave your bracelet in front of that tag, and it would collect that piece of art for you. Okay, and then as you move through the museum, there were various places where you could pick up what people had collected from this RFID tag, and it could be projected, or it could be when you approach a table, your aura would then be projected on the table itself. And we worked with a very interesting group of people. We worked with a Moto design for the hardware design because we need a dual touch screen. And we worked with post-tool design to develop an idea. This is a video, so I need somebody to click this forward for me, of how the table would work and how your gallery wall would unfold on the table and how pieces of art that you had collected would show up, and then how you would get a little bit of information about that piece of art. Now, of course, you could take this bracelet home with you and put this on your own computer and remember your visit, or you could also meet and gather and exchange collections and information with other patrons. We also had this information lounge where some of the collections that people had made would be projected on a screen up above, which was all interesting, and we had about 90% proof of technology. We didn't quite get the last 10% because of the dual touch screen. This next project is sort of begins to address both the idea of rethinking how people work, but also a very strong connection to landscape. And I think this is something that is a thread throughout our work, not only understanding the native landscape, but also the cultural landscape of where we build. So we began this project. It was for Great Plains Software. It was later bought out by Microsoft. And so it's a very interesting group of people, a very fast-growing company in Fargo, North Dakota. And thus you see the sort of landscape of Fargo and the sort of facade articulation that we created. The greatest cultural artifact of the plains is certainly the shelter belt, which are the rows of trees that prevent the northwest winds from blowing everything off. You know, there's probably about an average on the Great Plains about 10 to 12 feet of organics. And so this isn't something that you want to dry out and blow into the next state or farm. So we had this idea that this software developer that would be in such a landscape as Fargo, North Dakota, would certainly need to be very agile, but also very connected to the landscape. Their name was Great Plains Software, and that idea of the expansive landscape was a big part of their identity. So we worked with Arup's engineers to develop a strategy for developing the building in such a way that it was totally mobile. You could pretty much plug and play throughout the building. And it became very much dependent on these distributed IT towers and air distribution towers. So you can see this is a diagram of the mechanical systems of the project. This is maybe perhaps a more specific diagram, which shows a raised floor system in which all air and IT is distributed and allows a very expansive sort of sense of the landscape. We've got a 90-foot expanse of space in which you can develop wherever you want to work, whatever teams you want to configure. We had heard anecdotally that if a guy doesn't, you know, if he's changed to a different team, he simply would put his computer on his chair and then roll it to the next compartment and move. And so the idea of being able to do that in a plug-and-play ritual without having to call up the facilities guy was very interesting to us. And that's what this building allowed them to do. And here you see the sort of sense of not only this the idea of the raised floor being sort of rendered in this warm wood, but also this sort of long expanse of steel that comes to this round column and just stops, and so it has this sort of sense of lightness. That connection is managed in the air floor above. Of course, we couldn't leave it at, okay, now come in and put your steel case or Herman Miller in here, whatever you want. So we designed these mobile office units, which were very stiff corners of a cubicle that were then stapled together and could be taken apart, put on a pallet, and moved by the occupants to their new location. So the idea that, of moving very quickly. Of course, very nice outdoor spaces to work. You have to understand, in Fargo, there aren't very many moments in the year where you can live outside. And so this idea was to create this wind block from the northwest that would actually create a sort of a microclimate for this workspace. And then I actually love this image because that's pretty much the idea of Fargo, that it's incredibly flat. We had 80 acres of site to program here, and we had to get 6-inch topographic increments in order to have any lines on the topography at all, which is something that you might be familiar with. And is it the eastern part of your state? Is that correct? The western? Well, whatever. Yeah. So, and this is the end of the building as it enters into that shelter belt. What was interesting about Fargo is the Red River of the North actually flows north, which makes no sense, because it also freezes south to north. And so you end up with these incredible floods every year. And so the entire building is raised up just 18 inches because it's like pouring a glass of water on a tabletop. It just goes forever, but not very deep. So this is actually our flood protection. This is a much more extraordinary site in terms of its topography, a project that we did. We had 57 acres and a mile of coastline in the Bay of Fundy. And we had clients that wanted a house that was really a weekend retreat. In fact, it wasn't even a weekend retreat. It was maybe 2 months out of the year, maybe in the spring and the fall. They would go to Maine. They were a retired couple, sat on a number of boards, were very active, but just wanted this place to get away, slow down the pace, and connect themselves with this really profoundly astounding, compelling landscape. And so this idea of the retreat was pretty much at the basis of this design, but it was also out of a sense of respect for this landscape and the ability to sit on it in a very light manner. I mean, literally the excavation for this project was rolling back this green turf that you see here. It's sort of a mat, and you would roll it back, and then there would be the competent granite below. Certainly the project is sort of anti-functionalist. This is maybe anti-pragmatic, if you will, that you would come into the house, turn around, walk, you know, the opposite direction, and then walk again toward the water in order to rise to the second floor. But then the walls of that stairwell frame that what they call in Maine bold ocean. And so the idea of the project may be becoming a little bit less convenient, but becoming more profoundly connected to the site, was really rethinking the house in a pragmatic but not pragmatic way. And again, Mary Beth, an incredible cook, who really said, okay, this is the different place. This is the place that's not my primary residence. And so my kitchen becomes two parallel bars, and you simply pull the wine out of the refrigerator and put the lobster in the pot, and that's your dinner. A much simpler way of living than her normal existence. And pretty much this incredible rocky terrain. We actually hiked out here to look at this site in early March, and it was quite extraordinary. After that experience, I thought, you know, this is such a good idea. So my husband and I were up on the north shore of Lake Superior and found a piece of land quite close to this ore boat loading facility. So there's this sort of natural environment, but also has this very strongly industrial character, and built a tiny retreat house for ourselves. This one we do get to on the weekends, and it's about 3.5 hours north of Minneapolis. And we can go up there in the summer and the winter. We love it in the winter. It's quite extraordinary. And the house is really built for this particular landscape. So it's a passive solar house. It heats up in the winter on a sunny day. We have to actually open the windows, and which is quite an extraordinary feeling when it's 30 below out. But it does allow you to hear the water. The Lake Superior rarely freezes over, so there's always some water movement. And quite often during the extraordinary storms, you can really feel that sort of thundering water on the rocks right in the structure of the house. In the summertime, we have the lake never really heats up much more than maybe 55, 65 degrees, so we always have cool breezes off the lake, and we can get really extraordinary cross ventilation because the windows are 4 feet by 10 foot tall. And the site is, there's Sawtooth Mountains are behind, there's a wetland, and then the water just filters its way down. It's a very rocky soil, so water moves rather quickly, and we really didn't want to disturb the hydrology of the site. So the house is lifted up to allow water to move rather freely below it. This is a large table where everything happens, and the cabinets where everything goes after it happens. We actually have to have a code on the doors so that we can tell what's behind which door. We have this sort of, it's in the shop. No, it's in the office. It's in the pantry or the linen closet. And this is actually maybe one of the most succinct ways of explaining what it's like to be in this house, where you're actually comfortable physically, temperature-wise, but you have this incredible, quite frozen landscape behind. It's a very relaxing and powerful experience. Oh, I wanted to cut back just... This was quite a different house for a very good friend of mine and his partner. Andrew is the design director of the Walker Art Center and the curator of architecture. So he's got a few opinions. but fortunately, we share opinions. And the reason I want to bring that up is that Andrew and I really first bonded as we came to Texas. We went to Marfa for one of the events at the Chinati Foundation and got very interested in the Judd concrete, which, you know, had this opportunity, then we would have had a different experience. But the concrete here was really something quite powerful. And so we thought, you know, if Andrew and Scott ever got around to buying a lot, that we would do a concrete house. And the second floor, as you can see, is sort of this shell that drops down onto it and creates this kind of effect where we have the concrete base, the house is pretty much here, and then this is a courtyard, and then the garage beyond, and obviously a two-story, really rather contextual house, believe it or not. This is a very two-story neighborhood. We took advantage of a rather taller floor-to-floor since we stayed on grade and we don't have a pitched roof, so we had 11-foot floor-to-floor. Some very minimal but operable openings throughout the house. A long corridor that leads. The house is inverted, so the front room is not the living room. as is typical. It's the guest room, and as you go beyond, you come into the living room, which is now a two-story space that gives out onto the courtyard beyond and garage. And this was actually a shoot for Dwell magazine. And I don't know if you guys ever go to Unhappy Hipsters, but it's a great little website. And I think this was on Unhappy Hipsters as the roommate situation was working quite well until he started looking over my shoulder. Which is kind of I love that. And then I love Unhappy Hipsters. Okay, so just a couple more projects. And this project for me really combines the sort of two themes that I've discussed, this interest in the natural landscape, the cultural landscape, and the sort of pragmatics of a very demanding functional project. And so this is the land port of entry in War Road, Minnesota. As we were crossing, sort of doing our initial site visit before we got this project, we were there in January, and it's a pretty remarkable landscape in January. Very flat, very cold, and very wind-driven. And the project was actually moved a third of a mile down the road from the actual border because of poor soils. And so we wanted a project that had some weight and some sort of quality to it, some dignity to it. And so we wanted it rendered in a very dark color in this sort of wintry landscape. But then we also felt that there needed to be this sort of welcoming portal to the United States. And so this is the final project, certainly not in the winter. But the idea would be that the exterior of the project, again, is in this warm, or the black stained cedar, and then the warm heartwood for the portals as you pass through the port. And so this is the sort of diagram for how the project is conceived, and this is the sort of sensibility of moving through the port, approaching the port on foot. The project is a very demanding program from Customs and Border Protection, requiring a sort of 360-degree surveillance of the site. And so rather than simple bars in the landscape, the forms were inflected to allow better sight lines. And also there you can see the sight line looking north toward the border, which is way the heck up there. Didn't mean to go that quickly. And to respond to the turning radiuses of vehicles as they move through primary inspections, secondary inspections, and commercial inspections, and then ultimately leave the port. I have been accused of designing buildings as if they were furniture, and this is sort of a sense of that. As you sort of have this knife edge transition from the black cedar to the warm stained heartwood. And the vehicles move through the port. The major, this is the entire sum total of the public space of the port. It's about 300 square feet. And it's not about having people come and stay. It's about moving people through the port. So this is, it's doing a port project has been likened to doing a military compound and a toll booth combined. And so we wanted to raise the bar on that expectation just a tad. This is a site plan that was developed by our landscape partners, Shane Cohen's firm, where we were using this very interesting deep Virginia shale that was laid in this sort of shingle pattern. So if somebody misses their turn coming around the corner, they do not disturb our landscape. It also allows a great deal of absorption of the runoff into the land itself. And so it sort of allows some sense of absorption. The trees are a very skinny little birch tree, and the idea there is Customs and Border Protection will not allow anything a Canadian can hide behind. And so this is actually true. They don't allow anything other than a 1.5-inch caliper, which is a pretty darn skinny Canadian. And we joked about this all the time, but they actually have a pretty good sense of humor, and we had utmost respect for the people that run the ports and really put their lives on the line every day. So they're quite remarkable people and just a ton of fun to work with. We talk about it as working with guys who carry guns and a client that prints its own money. So it's not a bad deal. I highly recommend it. So this is a sort of sustainable diagram of the entire site, looking at sustainability as a very integrated approach rather than a piecemeal approach. So we're using natural barriers to create microclimates to protect from harsh northwest winds. We're taking water and we're filtering it on a course as it moves back towards the... This is really built on a bog. We're developing... picking up water off the roof and using it as a gray water system, using natural light to light the inspection areas, and using a geothermal system to produce a good part of our heating and cooling, resulting in a port that has about a 60% reduction in purchased energy, which I think is a fairly remarkable achievement using very proven technologies and not really trying to go out and try to do the wind farms that may or may not really produce what we need for the port. This is an image of the project soon after it was built. So the next project I'm going to take a little bit different tact, a little bit more time with, if you'll bear with me. This is a second land port of entry, but I want to talk a little bit here about our process, not ad nauseum, hopefully just enough. This is a port in Maine, and it's on the St. John River. And what's interesting about what happens on the coast of Maine, or the border of Canada and what would it be, Quebec and Maine, is that you have these twin towns. You have a town on either side of the border, and it was really settled as a single community. And along comes the border, and suddenly you've got St. Leonard, and you've got Van Buren, and you've got to go through customs. Every time you go from one community to the next, you visit your siblings across the way. And there are literally tons of people that make this movement every day. It's both connecting and dividing the community. And so this was something that we thought was very interesting. We began to do what I call sort of site research. And so we were interested here in the sort of figure and field of the treat areas of Maine that were then stripped and used for agriculture. So you have a figure ground sort of sense of the landscape. And then you have this incredibly beautiful rolling topography of the St. John Valley, the waters that really create the commerce that was originally part of the valley, the agriculture. And the current commerce, which is all about moving goods along that border and across the border. Most profoundly, I think we found a culture there that's based on the Acadian culture, which is a French culture, very similar to what you find in New Orleans, and a very proud community. You really need to go there to hear French spoken with a Maine accent. It's quite amazing. And they're very proud of their heritage, and you'll see it celebrated in a number of ways, as parades in the summer and the Arcadian village, and there's a very intense engagement with the families and their relationships to this culture. And here you see a piece that we dug up from the library in Maine, or in Van Buren, that shows land divisions that are all related to the waterways of the region. And this is very similar to what you see if you fly into New Orleans. You'll see these long strips of land that are defined and give everybody access to the waterway, which shows up again as a strong influence for our approach to the project. And here you see the sort of edge conditions where we're building in Van Buren. To call that an urban edge is a bit overstating. So this is clearly a village, but it did have very much a residential edge to it. And then there's a bluff edge and then the river. More importantly, looking at this elongated site, the challenges that would certainly arise from Customs and Border Protection really trying to see not only the bridgehead coming from Canada up the street and all the way to the end of the site, and then the various conditions of winter, spring, and fall. So our project really began with our first presentation, in which we talked, we were asked to deliver three options, which, excuse me, for us were three versions of a building form and three versions of skin, because there really isn't a whole ton of wiggle room given what CBP demands of the project. So let me quickly go through several layers of the single landscape plan that we proposed, which began with this idea of the swale. We were very sensitive to the fact that we didn't want to dump all of the water runoff into the river itself, so we wanted to collect it in the swale. It came from these minor swales, and then the water was slowed as it made its way toward the swales by this sort of berms. Now, we called these security berms because the idea here was to keep people from leaving the road and hightailing it across the site. And then the tree bands were actually mimicking those sort of striations of landforms as they come toward the water, and then the sort of collection of all of the layers of the landscape. So three strategies began with the idea of this color indexing of the landscape, where we were taking these fall colors, and then the fact that you could see down on the port from the town. So let's wrap the skin around and up over the canopy and then down and around the next building. Oop, that didn't go. And so this is just some ideas to sort of give you the flavor and texture of how that might work with the buildings. Excuse me. And a section for how it would work. Second idea began with the idea of these, again, these striations that we found in the sort of native weaving, the land formations, and this sort of disjuncture in the weaving. You can see in this image here where it comes to this sort of stitch line and everything shifts. And so the idea was, in this skin, you would see this shift line. And again, sort of floating. I don't know how we thought we were going to float those canopies. They were helium-filled canopies. And sort of this perforated material that had this shift line. And then looking at the native stone of the area, could we stack the stone, still create this sort of abstraction of those land divisions in the skin as it moves around and enclose the port, and then have this sort of warm wood canopy floating above. So these were three ideas. Then we came to our last idea. This is after a peer review, and what's interesting about the Design Excellence Program is they invite three other architects in to discuss your project with you and in front of your client. Excuse me. So that, sorry, worked out real well. So I'm just going to go through quickly the detail that was brought to the project. Sorry. Dry throat, I guess. again, looking at geothermal heat exchange, adding a biodiesel peak load, back-ventilated facade, a solar thermal wall, and putting it all together. I'm going to go to the final skin. Hopefully these will speak for themselves. This was a screen-printed glazing with ideas about surveillance and camouflage. Again, using an interior wall that would create that kind of back glow. And the final renderings. Oh, that was quick. And then this would be the face of the port towards the city. And as you leave the port. So, great. Just in time, I can... thank you for inviting me. It's been just a pleasure to present our work and Ando-san's work. So thank you very much.
Working with say immigration or a port of entry, do you feel like they came with a lot of baggage about how things should be, and was that process one that was perhaps easier than you thought to break down those barriers, or was it really a struggle throughout?
It was very interesting because you're working for two clients. You're working with the GSA Design Excellence Program, which has the highest standards of providing design excellence. And you're working with Customs and Border Protection, whose mission is to accelerate trade and travel, to ignite legal trade and travel, and to secure our nation's borders. And they don't care about anything else. They don't care. And so the Design Excellence Program was really seen as an impediment to getting more ports, more up-to-date ports, getting them faster and getting them cheaper. So, thank you. So it was interesting to us to actually be able to deliver our ports on an accelerated schedule and within the congressional appropriation. And so for us, we felt very strongly that design excellence means not only that you have operationally efficient port that works well within its context, that is sustainable, that represents the nation well, but also is delivered quickly, on time, and within the budget. I think it's critical. Yeah, you've got one more.
Yeah. Who, me?
Yeah, you.
Okay, sorry. can you kind of break down the... What percentage of your work in this area is modular, and which is, and what percentage is totally specific to a given site? I mean, how reproducible is a port structure from one area of the border to another?
That's a great question, because Customs and Border Protection has its standards, and its standards are about a foot thick. And among those standards are the small port prototype, and the medium port prototype, and the large port prototype. Each one of those has to be completely reinvented, given the geometries of the site, given the traffic conditions. So, for instance, in Van Buren, Maine, we had a commercially capable port there before, but there was no commercial traffic. So this one would have commercial traffic. We had no way of predicting how much. We had three pedestrians a day each way, we had, you know, a certain amount of POV traffic, passenger-occupied vehicle, or privately-owned vehicle. And in addition, we had, like, on a certain day in the middle of winter, 100 snowmobiles would come through the port. So, you know, you can't really say that a commercially capable port will be able to do 100 snowmobiles. So, you know, there's no point in making a port prototype, small port prototype in Mexico that has the capability of processing 100 snowmobiles. So, you know, so much of the port is dependent on the specific functional considerations of each site, the specific configuration of the site, and certainly the cultural, economic, and, you know, sort of every part of the context of the site. So for the ports, I think they're very specific, very site-specific. Now, there are particular things that we took from our Warburg port to our Van Buren port, and there were certain things that CBP loved about our Warburg port, and they wanted to do again in Van Buren. And so this idea of sort of bringing the traffic around the main building and between the main building and the commercial inspections was not something they'd ever done before, but it was a way of sort of connecting all of those buildings and creating a cover for the officers in inclement weather, which happens occasionally in Minnesota. So to me, those are quite specific to the site. I think there are certain houses that we've done that I think you could probably pick up and place carefully in another place. I know that's anathema to most architects to say that, but I think if you think about really good product design, you can pick up and put in another place in an appropriate way. And so, you know, there are certain things that I think we can do that are modular, if you will, but we haven't really tested that. We've never done anything but sort of one-off, tailored projects. The products are different. You have another question.
Yeah, it's actually almost two questions. How much of your proposal was accepted on those two ports?
On the two ports?
Yeah, I know they want these, they propose these, and how much of how far they went in changing your...
They didn't get to change much. Because here's the thing, I mean, nobody changed, I mean, there were certain changes that happened as happens in construction where, you know, you bring in another group of subcontractors, they have a better idea than you do. You know, that's a welcome change. If you manage your design process in such a way that there is no compromise of the port operations, and you manage it in such a way that there's no compromise of the budget or the schedule, not much changed. Now, the second port that I showed you, the Van Buren port in Maine, was an ARRA project, so that was American Recovery and Reinvestment. So what we did was we took it through as far as I showed you. And then we did bridging documents to give to a design build contractor that would take it the next step and hire another architect to complete our documents. So we were very fearful of this project and we got a little lull in a tizzy. And so we detailed the living daylights out of that skin. And so we said at least the exterior of the building would be what we said. And so we did almost complete contract documents on a 35% schematic design submission. And it's going up right now, and it looks incredible. We were very lucky to have an incredible contractor and a great architect partner. So it doesn't sound like we compromise much, does it? But I think if you're smart about the way you approach the project, hopefully you won't need to compromise much. Now, the house up north, that was a different matter. Right. I was the client. Yes.
Were there any influences brought to bear about what type of materials or procurement you were to use or certain manufacturers or corporations that you were supposed to go to as opposed to others?
For the federal projects?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, for the federal projects, of course, you have to buy America, you know, which means America, well, the United States, Canada, and Mexico. But you also are required to meet LEED Silver, or better yet, gold, which we've met on both of our projects. And so you've got your 500-mile radius question. And so, you know, we took that quite seriously. And of course, you know, when you have a Buy America Act and you're on a border, you know, you kind of cut that down. So we had strong preferences for American product. And then went out, I think our precast was from Canada. So, you know, 90% of what we put into the ports is American. Certainly all the labor is. And I think there was a particular onus because of the ARA. And so that was boots on the ground. You know, that was getting people out there as fast as we could. What was interesting was the design process went way in advance of the site procurement process. That was, I mean, they had to buy land from the railroad. I mean, that's not an easy task. So, but everything is quite local. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you have
project. Hopkins.
Huh?
Hopkins, Minnesota?
No, Hopkins,
Texas. Oh, okay. Sorry.
I'm borrowing my money here. You have projects that are very different in scale, the manufacturing, the escape homes, border patrol things. Is there any one type of project that represents the bread and butter for your firm more than another?
No, you know, it's really interesting. We sort of landed on this GSA relationship far prior to the sort of 2008 financial crisis, and thank God. So that, you know, design excellence projects are our bread and butter right now. And so I think, you know, we've always set out to say that our intention is to make our bread and butter client somebody that demands more from architecture and that has very high aspirations for the architecture, or it just doesn't make sense to have us on the project. And so that's kind of, you know, it sounds a little bit arrogant, but we're just trying to be specific. And so we are building now, because that means that you have to reinvent yourself so frequently, I'm getting to the point where I really want to start building some expertise in particular areas. And so we're seeing a developing workload in residential and in federal projects. And now much more infrastructural projects. Very intrigued with how you can add value to infrastructure.
Yeah. Good answer, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Everybody ready to get out of here?